My people believe in the great balance. We are either predator or prey. Now, I realize the great balance is a lie.
Ships are powering up their weapons.
Warm up the phasers. Whoever's listening, consider your next move very carefully.
They're capable of destroying every village across the planet.
They are committing genocide?
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
here's Tyler Orton eating a delicious slice of galaxy pie.
We're here this week to talk about the sixth episode in the second season of Star Trek Discovery, The Sound of Thunder.
Cam, the sound that I'm hearing is roars from the crowd looking at Saru going, maybe this is the breakout character so far in season two of Star Trek Discovery. Following this episode and A Noble for Charon, what are you feeling about the journey that we've been following with Saru at this point?
You say he's the breakout character. What about Pike?
I think you can make an incredibly good argument for Pike with regards to how much he's been featured consistently episode to episode. Mm-hmm. If I'm looking at the big standout moments, the big highlights of the season, not to make a bad pun or accidentally use the word spike when I don't mean to, but right. I see the real spikes of the season coming from Saru so far, like the big emotional highlights, the stuff that I'm truly invested in versus kind of the awesome consistency that we've been getting so far of Pike.
Yeah, a lot of season two Discovery has felt like trying to correct the mistakes of season one. And, you know, we talked last week about an episode that did it in a way we thought was pretty clumsy and often kind of annoying. But one of the things I think season two has done really well is correct the problems that we found with Saru in season one, where it was a character with boundless potential that offered so much. You had a great performance from Doug Jones. You have an iconic look that, you know, immediately you remember right out of the gate. That makeup is just fantastic. And yet his character seems so adrift most of season one.
He had his moments, though.
He had moments. I would say there was promise, but you were waiting for that Measure of a Man moment where you're like, this is the kind of the quote-unquote other Star Trek character that is going to explode. Because when this show was being announced, when they were casting, I don't know about you, but I had every belief in that moment when I heard Doug Jones had been cast that this was going to be one of the breakout characters. And I watched season one of Discovery going like, well, not yet.
I think we were waiting. We got some moments in, say, an episode like Choose Your Pain.
Yeah.
And I think it really took until the last half of that Mirror Universe arc where we were like, oh, this is a man who has kind of the sort of like strength of a commanding officer that we would love to see on a series here. Cam, a podcast doesn't work unless there's like immense amounts of hyperbole.
Sure.
Is this episode, Sound of Thunder, the Measure of a Man episode for one Saru at this point?
At this point?
Yeah.
You know,
it's a season two, midway through.
A Noble for Charon, I thought, was really powerful.
Do you think this was a stronger...
This was a much more Saru episode than that was. That one has a lot of plot lines bouncing around.
A stronger Saru outing? Because you and I, we actually had very mixed... some more complex feelings about A Noble for Charon. This one, I feel a little bit more consistent about this one. Mm-hmm. I have to say, honestly, this is probably my second favorite episode after New Eden so far in Star Trek Discovery Season 2. And I think they are correcting... I don't say that they're actively correcting. I think what it is going towards what we like to see in Star Trek Discovery, which is a very focused storyline, which you can point to this and say, oh, this is the Saru Returns to Kaminar episode.
Yeah.
Whereas you point to an episode that we had last week, Saints of Imperfection.
Yeah.
And it's just like this mishmash of different storylines that just seem like an incoherent narrative mess.
It's the Things Happen episode.
Yes.
Yeah.
So to me, I think this is a very, very strong outing for Star Trek Discovery. Not quite up there for me with just kind of that gut reaction that I had with New Eden, but I just think that everything they're doing with Saru so far this season, even in the times that he's been on the sideline doing his exposition thing, which is, you know,
like last week, yeah.
Like last week, you know, I like where they're going in that they are going all out with this character. They are saying, you know what, we need to spring this character forward. I do raise one concern with you, though.
Mm.
Do you think that Saru was introduced as a very distinct character, one that we really haven't seen before? He was kind of guided by fear.
Yeah.
That is gone now.
Yeah.
Do you think they just...
Now he shoots spines.
I thought that was kind of one of the most badass moments in all of Star Trek.
Yeah.
But do you think that they thought, hey, you know what? We've gone as far as we can with this sort of character, and let's go to the next level? Or do you think this is more of a story-driven decision?
I think it is story-driven. Like, this does feel like the evolution of a character in a way we didn't get on all the other Star Trek shows.
Does it seem a little quick to you?
It does seem very quick.
Yeah. Because
this is only season two. Is Saru by the, you know, seventh season of Discovery?
He's literally colored green, looking like Lou Ferrigno. You know, like, to me,
he's now played by Lou Ferrigno.
As much as I really do think this is a great episode, I would say that what makes me take a step back, though, is I think there's actually a lot of room to go with Saru, with him as kind of that character who's guided by that sense of fear.
This does feel a little like Data with the emotion chip in, like, season two of TNG, like right after Measure of a Man.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You'd be like, okay, so it's not quite the Data that we had been building up for the first two seasons. But the thing is, like, as much as Data is like such an amazing character, he does seem a little bit static within Star Trek The Next Generation,
for
even
sure.
though you 100% see a character arc and you do see character growth within those seven seasons. I'm
definitely
totally giving him that at that point.
And same with like a character like Odo on DS9 as well.
For sure. But, you know, I think Odo had a stronger character arc than
I
say Data would. But, okay, Cam, I'm going to throw it at you.
Yeah.
So far, where is this episode measuring up for you so far this season? Like,
does it measure up to the man?
I mean, you can tell, like, I'm really digging this one. And I don't know how much of it is just, like, I was really kind of bummed out by the previous episode.
Yeah. Well, I think we've said that. I think it's every second episode of season two of Discovery is really good.
Well, do you know what it is? It's like I find that they jump from mythology episode to standalone episode, and standalone being relative here.
Sure.
And I think 100% their standalone outings are much stronger than their mythology outings.
I agree, because when I watch this episode, it feels so focused, and it has genuine, like, emotion coming out through the storytelling. Like, Saru's whole reunion with his sister, I thought, was absolutely fantastic. And, I mean, this is shocking coming after last week's episode. The show lets it breathe. It gives you those moments. Just watch the characters interact with each other and kind of take it all in. Like, there's moments where Burnham's just watching the two of them reunite. But, and that's something that last week never would have happened.
No.
We would have been barreling through that moment to get to the next scene.
Well, is literally husbands reunited with each other.
Yeah.
And they're like...
in like 15 seconds.
Yeah. And okay, well, now it's time for a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, oh.
But okay. Like, you know, this was really smart where you had the central story of Saru going back to his home planet. And yeah, you had all the Ark stuff and, you know, Tilly with the, you know, the information from the sphere and all that in the background. It was there to contribute when needed, but it wasn't fighting for focus throughout the entire story. It was like they picked their story and went with it. And I think that's the smartest thing you can do, not just in Star Trek, just in general TV storytelling.
Yeah. So the other thing that I think is worth bringing up here, though, is like one of our complaints about the previous episode. And let me just say this. I think it is a very difficult ask for our audience, the Subspace Transmissions audience, who they're obviously tuning in to hear our thoughts about Star Trek Discovery because they enjoy the series. You don't really tune into a podcast because you dislike the series. And then when you have the two hosts of the show really come down hard on an episode like Saints of Imperfection, I think that's kind of a tough listen for fans of the series. And
right.
I really want to emphasize the fact that, you know, we're only being tough on it because we're definitely invested in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you come back strong with an episode like this, it just reemphasizes to you, the listener, how much we are invested in this.
Right.
So I do feel bad about how hard we came down on last week's episodes. But Cam, I listened back to it. I don't think we were unfair to the faults going on in the previous week at all. And
I don't feel that way from my subjective point of view.
Yeah.
No, not at all. But I mean, also, it's not like we come on every week and just trash Discovery.
No, exactly. So, I think we've always been fair. We've acknowledged the great strengths of the series, yeah. But I think it would be like I would not be able to listen to a show that is just nothing but like salivating over like every crappy moment in a series that really could do better. And right. It has proven itself capable of, you know, better moments than what we got last week.
That's why you never have launched your Star Trek spinoff novel podcast, because no one wants to hear you fawn over those novels every week.
So I've given so many novels a shot.
Yeah.
In the Star Trek canon, there's like a couple that I like, but boy, Cam, nobody wants to listen to my thoughts on Star Trek novels because I would just be kind of crapping on like how they feel like fan fiction.
Sure.
Or cam fiction.
Right.
Kaminar, is that officially the favorite name of a planet ever in your mind?
I mean, Discovery has given us two gifts, a character named Tyler and a planet named Kaminar.
Yes.
What more can I ask for?
I know. He's now Agent Tyler, which, yeah. Did you not think it's weird? Okay, I still cannot wrap my head around exactly what Section 31 is, because he's Captain Leland, but it's Agent Tyler.
Yeah.
I have no idea what Giorgio is referred to at this point. I think Section 31, the way that they are, you know, revealing it to be, is just a complete mess. I don't understand it whatsoever.
And Ash Tyler's just moping around on the ship, and you're like, okay.
In a uniform.
Yeah, in a uniform.
With a black badge.
Yeah.
For some reason. He didn't have a uniform on last week for some reason. I just don't get any of it.
I'm hoping that we can find out why this character's on the ship other than he was in season one.
I think that's what it is, though.
I'm going to give them a little bit of breathing room on that one and just be like, okay, we're going to hopefully get to an episode where this justifies itself, but at the moment it's a little strange.
He's going to be revealed as a Romulan double agent.
Is Ash Tyler now playing like TNG Worf, who's there to make the suggestions that are wrong?
Okay. Here's what I think Ash Tyler is here to do. I think he's here as a test for the writers. The writers are like, hey, let's challenge ourselves. Let's see how we can reintegrate this character into the series. It's probably an actor that they like, that they see, who has a lot of talent. Because as much as we've kind of like been like, not bashing Tyler, but like questioning what his direction is on the series, I think we actually like the performance of one Shahzad Latif. I think we were blown away by like Voke. That performance as a character.
Yeah.
And you look
at The Wolf Inside, where he has the transitions. Say, yeah.
The Wolf Inside. He had the transition on that planet. He also had that confrontation with Burnham, which I still think might be the best, you know, 5 minutes of Star Trek Discovery so far.
Yeah.
So I think the writers are recognizing there's a lot of potential here. I just don't know if they know how to tap into that at this point.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see if they can crack that character. I think there was a lot of potential to have a character who has that Klingon side of himself, but he doesn't seem very Klingon-y.
Alexander Rozhenko.
He seems like emo a lot of the time. He just seems kind of like a mopey character, whereas I want to have a little bit of that fire to this character that I think could be really cool.
He is
the torchbearer, after all.
I know, but the thing that bums me out most, though, is that he does not have a man bun anymore now that he's on a Starfleet ship. I really wanted our first Starfleet character with a man bun. Jonathan Frakes, it's up to you. If it's revealed that, in fact, you are the Red Angel doing time travel in this mechanized suit. Okay, Cam, I feel as we're jumping around just because there's so much going on in this episode, but
And yet it seems very focused.
It really does, though. Yeah. And this is why I think this is a very, very strong outing for Star Trek Discovery. But okay, so we get more of the Red Angel mythology. And the thing is, I think this is actually very smart, because you and I have been complaining about how this Red Angel stuff, they don't really seem to be going anywhere. There's hints, but like stuff that adds up to just like gobbledygook.
Yeah.
Here we actually get a character saying it appears to be a humanoid with a mechanized suit with technology that is beyond our capability. I'm like, okay, now you're actually like developing what this mystery is supposed to be about.
Right.
So let me ask you this. They're hinting.
Yes, I think it's Jonathan Archer.
Okay. Good God. I was actually, like, in my notes, I wrote Scott Bakula? Okay.
Because for those that don't know, you know, on in the Temporal War stories on Enterprise, where Archer's going and talking to, like, the shadowy Suliban character, and we see that character projected through hologram a lot. One of the theories that came out was that And I believe it was even like maybe Scott Bakula floated as well.
Are they even maybe Brandon Braga?
Maybe that it was Archer from the future talking to his younger self.
Yeah.
And so that's why when I see the Red Angel come out, I'm like, yep, it's future Archer in a Iron Man suit.
Well, let's talk about this because I think at this point with the hints that we're getting that this is supposed to be a time traveling character.
Yeah.
And as much as I'd love it for to be Admiral Archer.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
I don't think that's going to be the case. I think it is going to have to be revealed as a recognizable character from, say, the 24th century.
Picard? The tie into the Picard spinoff?
I don't think it'll be Picard, but that would be so amazing.
The Picard spinoff to be Patrick Stewart flying around timelines in an iron suit with wings.
I would love that. Yeah. You know? It's just like,
he's like, bet you never saw this coming.
This is why he decided to come back to the franchise.
The final frontier of awesome.
Yeah. But let's talk about who we think the realistic possibilities are of this Red Angel entity being, assuming that it is a recognizable character. There have been some theories that it's actually like an older Spock.
Yeah, around. But does that feel a little tired considering like 2009, you know, the movie 2009 where you have older Spock and young Spock? I don't know that you want to do that again. You
accusing Star Trek of ever being derivative of itself?
Yeah, but that would be a real stretch to kind of repeat that sort of idea again.
I don't think it's a huge, huge stretch, though. But I honestly
who's
don't.
Who's playing older Spock?
It's Ethan Peck. It's Zach Quinto in old man makeup.
I mean... I hope that's not the case.
Okay, I agree. I don't want it to be older Spock. But, like, who are kind of the realistic options if you're going to, like, a familiar face, you know? And I think that's kind of what they're building up. I'm not saying it's necessarily, like, a main character, but it's, like, a familiar face from the 24th century that is somehow trying to have an influence and correct maybe the wrongs that were going on a century earlier.
Boy.
Are there any obvious options at this point?
I just don't think Discovery is going to haul characters from DS9 or Voyager or Enterprise out of mothballs. I feel like it would have to be tied to TNG in some way.
Okay, so...
Data? Or B4?
Are we getting a B4, kind of like a mocap version of Brent Spiner?
Well, we know that Brian Fuller did say he was flirting with the idea of mocap Data.
I think Brent Spiner would be willing to, you know, do a day's worth of... you know, voice work to do this.
Why is Data doing this?
Well, Data's dead, Cam.
Why is B4 doing this?
Because he likes people's shiny heads? I don't know. According to Star Trek Nemesis?
Fair enough. And now he has the shiniest head in the galaxy.
Cam, you're asking me to place motivation on, like, an entity we know virtually nothing about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But okay, let me ask you this then. Would it be disappointing if this Red Angel mystery is revealed to be some sort of entity that we've not had any previous knowledge about?
I don't know. I guess my answer to that is I don't know. Right? It really depends on execution. Yeah, like, it could really work. But it, you know, okay, so I think of Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, where the whole movie is they're going to find God. And you know that whatever they're going to find on your movie screen is going to be a letdown. Because they can't actually show what God is, you know, in the movie. They just can't. And so they kind of set themselves up to fail there. And so, like, a case like this, it's a similar problem.
So wait, your theory is that the Red Angel is Cybok. I get it. That's why hey, he's
that
trying
would actually,
to look...
You know, they haven't mentioned Cybok at all.
He's
but...
trying to look out for Spock.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, it's like, I don't think they have that issue yet. Where they're promising something that they can't deliver. But if they do go that route and it is something entirely new, it's just some sort of cosmic being, they're going to have to really bend over backwards to deliver. Because I think that is a tough sell to really satisfy people unless it's delivering something to the series that feels just absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And we'll see. We'll see. Like, I have to believe that a lot of this season, and I don't know for a fact, but a lot of the season had to have started with, what if so-and-so, or what if this being, or whatever, was doing this in the past, and kind of engineering the arc out of that? Because this arc, so far, feels very bumpy with all the Red Angel stuff, so yeah. I feel like they're working backwards from a payoff.
I have to believe that's the case, But what, and here's my big fear, what if it's all a red herring and it might be, and it's just something
else? Well, I mean, I was taking a note earlier in this episode where I'm like, boy, this Red Angel seems to exist purely to justify normal Star Trek missions.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, well, the red lights have brought us to this place to now deal with a classic Star Trek, you know, trope.
Does this episode not feel very much in kind of the spirit of kind of the Star Trek we're most familiar with? I think we've got that in this season with New Eden. Mm-hmm. I think this one is kind of in that New Eden camp as well.
This one feels to me a little more DS9, like a lot of the Odo sort of changeling stories.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like to me, where it was actually dealing with his culture in a way that felt much more in-depth than you would see in a lot of the other Star Trek shows.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit more, because I watched this episode the night before.
Yeah.
And you mentioned it earlier, the Saru-Sarana reunion. I have to admit, Cam, I don't know what's going on in my apartment, if it's a ventilation issue or something, but maybe the room felt a little bit dusty.
You left the gas oven on.
I had chills. Like, I really, really, like, had an emotional response. And this is Iceman Orton we're talking about here.
Oh, boy, is that what you're dubbing yourself now?
Yeah, okay, so here's a story from age 11.
Okay.
When I was on my softball team, I was had the nickname Iceman Orton.
Was it because of Top Gun?
No, it was because when I was up in the batter's box and I'd be like swinging, mm-hmm. I was really stiff.
Oh, okay. And so it's not a flattering nickname.
No, not really. But anyways, when I watched it again this evening with you, I didn't quite have that same reaction, you mm-hmm. know, but I kept thinking back to that initial reaction that I had, and I wonder how much of it tied back to the fact that we were able to see the brightest star.
Yeah.
And I wonder for viewers that have not seen the brightest star, the short trek, mm-hmm. little dip
into Kaminar, which they recycled some footage of in this episode.
Which is interesting, and I think there's a little bit of retconning that we can get into as well. But I want to know, am I just totally out to lunch here? What was your reaction? And you alluded to this earlier, but tell me, did you have similar chills watching this Saru-Sarana reunion?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. Yeah. It was well written, and just the scene where, you know, Burnham walks up with the Universal Translator and is explaining it to Sarana. I'm like, this moment is so powerful for some reason.
I know. I've mentioned this on social media on, say, Facebook before, but like, has...
Friendster.
MySpace. Yeah. Has any other Star Trek series have, like, as much fun playing around with the Universal Translator as this series?
It's kind of its thing.
And I think they've been doing it exceptionally well here.
Yeah.
So in this situation, though, like I just even how the, like the music is swelling, everything worked for me. But Cam, I need to ask you this. Let's say it's 21st century Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a priest,
right.
And 18 years ago, my brother goes missing, and I'm in my church, you know, like at the collection plate, and my brother walks in. I haven't seen him in 18 years. He's like, "Yo, sis, I was abducted by aliens. Here's my alien friend." And my alien friend takes off her robe and like reveals an alien face. Does Sarana not seem like way cooler with it than like the average human being in the 21st century would?
I think to think she was just overtaken with emotion at seeing Saru again.
Okay.
She's like, you know what? I can deal with this other stuff.
She doesn't mind that her bro was like abducted. It claims that he was abducted by aliens and has become like the commander of a interstellar starship.
Well, she did see the the Georgiou shuttle fly away.
Okay.
So there is a basis for her thinking that, you know, he has gone somewhere special.
Can I get into the retconning just right now
before
I forget? Okay. So they established that it was the Archimedes that made the first contact with the Ba'ul. And I think we want to talk about the Ba'ul as well. And
I'd like to congratulate Discovery for breaking the trope of ugly aliens being evil. Because they were beautiful.
Yes. Well, I mean, like, yeah, obviously. So,
I like that they were scored to black metal.
Would this not have been the most badass aliens from about, like, 1998, 1999?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I can picture Jonathan Davies, you know, in the Freak on a Leash music video.
Oh, Jonathan Davis, yeah.
Jonathan Davis.
Yeah.
My apologies for all those Korn fans out there that I've just offended. But this is, like, straight out of the Freak on a Leash, like, music video.
When he started scatting, I thought it was a little distracting. Yeah.
So, but okay. So going back to the retconning though, they said is okay. Is the Archimedes that made first contact? Blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, when we watch The Brightest Star, the shuttle that Giorgio landed on, like, I think the shuttle actually said like SHZ or like SZN or something like that.
Yeah, it did have a Shenzo
like for
designation.
Me, it was very clear that it was a Shenzo like designation. And yeah. So now they're saying it's kind of an Archimedes deal, which honestly, at the time when we saw Brightest Star, I was like, so did Giorgio like serve on this ship for like 2 decades or yeah. something like that?
According to one of the novels, she was on the I believe the Narbonne or something like that for a while.
Okay.
I don't know.
Sure. She was drinking everybody out of their minds, according to one pike. So.
Right.
Or under the table, I should say. There you go. But I am fascinated by all the stuff going on the planet. Because, Cam, the thing you and I have been begging for more and more is just, like, we want to explore these strange new worlds.
Yeah, because Discovery can do things with these worlds the other Star Trek shows couldn't. If you just look at the set design on, you know, Kaminar, it looks incredible. And we've seen that on a couple of the other planets so far. And the other shows just didn't have those opportunities, whether it's just due to budget or resources, all that sort of stuff. That's why so many of the planets on the Berman era look like California.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, Discovery's doing really cool things, and it kind of bums me out when they don't exploit that.
Yeah, I still can't grasp as to why that is.
I mean, the J.J. Abrams movies, I didn't think exploited it very well either.
I honestly think the best one that did it, though, is Star Trek Into Darkness, that opening scene on the volcano planets.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this, maybe we can get into Ba'ul.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a stark resemblance to, say, one Armus from Skin of Evil, the one who killed Tasha Yar. Do you think this is purely coincidental? Do you think it's a bit of a nod to the fans? Or do you think that this is actually establishing them as the same species as Armus here?
There's no way they're paying tribute to Armus,
are they? Saying, like, don't you think it's kind of weird?
I do think it's weird.
Like, you have
these black oil characters?
Like this tar alien rising out of tar. But the other thing I want to think about, though, is that, well, I like that they're doing kind of a different sort of look for aliens. Like, honestly, the only other comparable alien that I can think of here in terms of design, I guess, would be Armus, but this looks 10 times better than Armus. Like, I love the ingenuity that goes into this sort of alien species that we're seeing here. I think, just with regards to alien design, I don't think anybody's doing it better than Star Trek Discovery so far.
No, it's been fantastic.
I've been incredibly impressed with everything.
To the best of my memory, and I haven't watched Skin of Evil in a long time, but wasn't Armus like some sort of creation of like all of the negative feelings of a planet or something?
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
It was something like that. He was some sort of manifestation of those, like the negativity of a populace or something like that. I don't remember. So,
but I go back to the voice.
Yeah.
Don't you think it was curious that initially Bryce said an audio only transmission and we only hear the voice and it sounds like an evil Optimus Prime, which is interesting. And then we get the actual revelation here that it's a very kind of one of those tar-like figures. Isn't this just like too much coincidence? I don't know.
I guess we're going to find out, maybe. But I just wonder if maybe they were like fans of the like, not the episode Skin of Evil, but the creation. Because it was something very unique and they wanted to kind of, you know, evoke it, but do their own little thing. Because Armus didn't have the big red eyes like this or the long hair.
What my argument might be, though, is maybe they're trying to fix one of the biggest blotches on Star Trek canon, which is the horrible episode that was Skin of Evil.
Right.
Let's try to give some depth and complexity to this alien species that everybody thinks is probably like one of the dumbest antagonists we've ever seen in Star Trek.
I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
Do you really understand how the Kelpians and the Ba'ul came from the same ecosystem?
Maybe they're like the Zindi, you know, because we saw the aquatic Zindis, we saw the
tar
insectoid.
Creatures is a real,
I know,
a real stretch.
But you know what? It's an alien planet. That's all I can say.
Right.
And look, I'll say it. The Zindi, like, look how disparate those characters. We even had like avian Zindis that they just simply didn't have the production budget to display them.
I mean, I guess on, you know, the X-Files, you had the different alien species, and the black oil was one of them.
So what, on the X-Files, they had, like, what, the green aliens?
Mm-hmm. Like the grays.
The grays, too, and the The black oil sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So maybe. And then I think there was also like the alien bounty hunter.
Yeah.
Things like that, shapeshifters.
I didn't like the alien bounty hunter.
I thought it was pretty cool.
I thought it was too powerful. That's kind of what bugged me.
Well, they did kill
him. Wasn't it Iron that killed them or something?
Oh, I can't remember now.
I think they had to go to like, and remember like the cigarette smoking man was like in like New Mexico hiding in like cliffs because there's,
now
like,
you're in the finale. You're in the final episode.
Well, there are like iron deposits there.
Yeah. I'm actually like midway through a multi-year rewatch of X-Files. So I get there, I'll be able to answer these questions.
I'm not trying to spoil anything for you, but like I remember in the finale, we watched the cigarette smoking man's body get incinerated down to a skeleton.
Yes.
And then he comes back in the reboot version
with
some scars on his face.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. And then Annabeth Gish, who I absolutely adore as an actress. She's such like this journeyman actress who's on so many series like that I absolutely love, like Brotherhood, which also featured one Jason Isaacs.
Right.
She was also on Halt and Catch Fire. She's in like every other TV series out there. I thought she was actually pretty good as Monica Reyes.
Mm-hmm.
Those like reboot seasons though, it was just such a thankless role. I felt bad for her. I'm just like, oh dear Lord.
Yeah.
Anyways.
But I want to talk about the Baul a little more.
No, you don't want to talk about like rebooted X-Files anymore?
I like that we brought up X-Files like three episodes in a row now. I did have a bit of a question. Like, are the Baul presented as a little bit too sinister in this episode? Where in Star Trek, we like to be able to recognize that, you know, say like, go back to the episode Arena from the original series. The Gorn comes across as like scary and threatening, but there's ultimately a sympathetic side to him, and we understand that character, and like the problem with the situation is not the Gorn by the end of that story. And with the Baul, I'm sympathetic to the idea that they were preyed upon, and that's terrible. But when you present them as this and then have them basically, you know, shackling Saru to walls, does it make them look unsympathetic?
And deploying these drones with like drilling devices aimed at their faces.
This was really completing the arc of the Saru Skywalker or Saruk Skywalker.
Saruk Skywalker.
Where his sister and him are on this, giant fortress that they have to escape from. And there are drones flying around and a villain in black that's shiny.
I get it. I think what the number one sin committed here by the creative team, though, is, again, falling back into the trope of like evil aliens look sinister.
Right.
I think if they had presented them in a different way, we would not necessarily have that issue, because then I think we could understand that this is a species that has been convinced for the last 2,000 years. And I also think it's interesting that they said 2,300 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's an interesting parallel if you go back to human history with maybe certain religions. I just wonder if they're trying to create analogs, because this is very much a faith-based sort of season.
Definitely.
And
this episode, very much so.
Very much so. And there's actually one point that I'm very glad that I watched this episode a second time before we did the podcast, because there's something that I picked up on that actually I'll get into in just a moment here. But I think the issue here with the Baul is that they display them as evil-looking characters, whereas I can kind of understand that they've created this institutionalized structure in order to preserve themselves as far as they understand it. And I think Saru, who has been kind of this enlightened version of a Kelpian who's been able to explore the galaxy, he says when they initiate the Vahari, or how is it pronounced?
Vahari.
Vahari. I'm still messing it up.
Yeah.
He says, we will show them that we don't have to be the predators, that we're enlightened enough. And I think that's a very Star Trek sort of thing,
Definitely.
Which is what I really dig. But the thing that I want to get to that I'm alluding to here is, I guess, Serana's arc.
Mm-hmm.
She's a priest here.
Right.
She comes to the realization that her faith is based on false premises.
Mm-hmm.
My big issue that I've had so far this season that I keep bringing up again is how it seems as if Discovery is presenting belief in a higher being as kind of a 50-50 sort of thing. Like,
right.
It's like, maybe there is an all-powerful creator. Maybe there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
How can we ever know? And I think this episode is actually presenting the fact that maybe it's possible for people to recognize that whatever their faith is could be based on false premises, and it is possible for us to reach into who we are as a species, which is going back to Gene Roddenberry's belief in humanism,
yeah,
as kind of something that can ultimately guide us and help us progress as a species. The reason I think this is very problematic, and I think Star Trek's been very good about it in the past, though, is because I think this could also be an idea that's incredibly offensive to a huge contingent of religious, you know, Star Trek fans.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't know how they're going to continue to kind of toe this line here. But for me, and I think I've bringing this up enough that I think it's worthwhile for those that did not listen to our Star Trek V, The Final Frontier episode from about, what, 4 or 5 years ago?
Almost five, yeah.
Yeah. I think you talked about, like, kind of your own spiritual journey, and then back, you know, when we did that episode, I spoke about mine, and, like, I was somebody that started going to church when I was, like, older in life. I was, like, 14, 15, and then it was something that I decided very vehemently that it was not something that I believed in when I was in my very early 20s. And so I'm kind of at that stage where, like, I think you would categorize yourself more as agnostic, and then I would, you know, categorize myself as atheist. So it is something that, like, I'm still grappling with this journey in Star Trek Discovery here.
Right.
And so what I'm getting is I want to be upfront with the listeners, you know, why I'm coming at it from this angle. The fact that you and I are having these thoughts, we're talking about in Star Trek, I think that's really what Star Trek should be doing, though. And I think that's, like, a good thing. And my concern, though, is, like, I think Star Trek should be challenging, you know,
yeah,
many
definitely.
Of our thoughts, you know. But to get to the point that maybe it's offensive to people, that's really what I'm concerned about. And I would not want to disparage anyone's spiritual beliefs, you know, mm-hmm. but I would also not want Star Trek to say that my own beliefs are just kind of a 50-50 sort of, like, a coin flip sort of idea. And I that's what my fear is right now, is that that's what they're trying to project.
Right.
In this kind of faith versus science journey that we're having so far this season.
Yeah, it's been really
interesting.
That's heavy,
interesting.
I know, it's very heavy. Yeah. It's been interesting to see how they've kind of bounced around. And that, like, some episodes, I'm actually quite shocked that they went there. Like, this episode to me felt very much about, like, you know, someone had, like, escaped from, like, say, like, a cult, coming back.
Yeah.
And being like, look, it's so much better out there. And, you know, then there's
I think that's a great parallel, Cam.
There's a line where the sister says, we feared reprisals when you left. And to me, I was like, whoa, like, this actually does feel like one of those, you know, more fundamentalist religions, or, like, you know, even like some of the cults you hear about, where you are, like, browbeaten into staying, and, you know, your family, you are cut off from them when you leave. I think of, like, the group in the States, the Westboro Baptist Church, which was headed by Fred Phelps. Like, you know, I've heard stories about family members that have left that group and then never, you know, had any connection with their family again after that. So that's the sort of thing I was thinking of. Those thoughts were going through my head as I'm watching this episode.
Yeah. And to take it to the more granular, I think it was very fascinating how Saru, he decides to leave his home planet.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, you know, I'll just leave it at that. I have my own existential, you know, challenge with this, because I am departing my father. I'm departing my sister. The sister says, you know what? We had a horrible time after you left. Like, mm-hmm. it shook us spiritually after your mm-hmm. departure here. And it's not guilt that he ever lived with. And I think it hits him kind of like a brick wall at this point. I don't think they should just dismiss it so easily. I do hope maybe some of it is addressed moving forward, but I'm skeptical that it will be. But I think that's a huge issue when you depart your family that way.
Yeah.
You don't think of the consequences until they're brought back to you. And I think there's very real consequences that really shape Sarada's life moving forward. She ended up becoming a priest in part because of Saru's decision.
And I really actually like the touch of Saru talking about his father, about how his father had led a lot of the Kelpians to, you know, this very grim fate.
Yeah.
But he says, you know, he was manipulated by the Bahul. Like, I actually liked that for once it wasn't like, my father was an evil man. You know, like, he was actually recognizing that his people had been misled and that the Bahul were basically taking advantage of them all this time. Because, you know, when you see the father character in The Brightest Star, he doesn't come across as the most likable character in the world.
Yeah. He seemed a little aloof.
he seemed a little aloof. Yeah. But I like the sense that they give a sympathetic edge to that character, as well as a tragedy, because just, you know, you think of what the father's entire life was and what his what it really added up to, and it's just very tragic.
Yes. Cam, how much of our enjoyment of this particular episode do you think is dependent on having seen The Brightest Star? Do you think that...
I think it helped a lot.
It helped a
lot. Brightest Star, I think, is actually pretty invaluable because, I mean, it's only, what, 12 minutes or whatever, 14 minutes, but just the moments with Saru and his sister in that episode alone, I thought, communicated far more than whole episodes of Discovery have at certain times in selling a relationship.
I'm definitely invested in this brother-sister relationship here, and I constantly go back to this episode from Star Trek The Next Generation, Who Watches the Watchers, but Sarana got her own Who Watches the Watchers moment when she was gazing at Kaminar from the Star Trek Discovery. I still don't think they quite captured that moment that we got when that proto-Vulcan woman, that council leader, was able to board the Enterprise and view it from the observation lounge. But still, I just kind of love that idea. Even think about, like, Lily from Star Trek First Contact, when she got to see Earth.
Right, yeah.
You know, like, I just love those moments about how amazing and mystifying space is.
Right.
I think Star Trek Discovery can seize on that more and more because I think, just let's be honest, the production values that they have access to are, you know, beyond anything that we've seen in any of the other series at this point.
For sure.
The other thing that I am curious, though, how do you think we are going with regards to Saru's character in that he's no longer guided by fear?
Yeah.
And I thought that if there was ever going to be an argument against Saru becoming captain, I would have feared that the big issue that would have really held him back is that you're constantly going to have a captain guided by fear, which means would Burnham not be undermining him as the potential first officer in this situation?
Right.
If he's no longer guided by fear, do you think we are setting up for season three with Saru in the captain's seat? Or do you think that Star Trek Discovery, this is ultimately the journey about Burnham, and we're ultimately going to see Burnham in the captain's seat? I don't think Pike is coming back for season three as captain.
Right.
So I'm wondering where the captain's seat is going to go by the time we get to next season.
Does Saru seem ready to be captain at this point? Because I would have said so at the end of season one.
Yeah.
But we have, like, the moment here where he's going at Pike on the bridge about, you know, going back down to his planet, and Pike's iffy on that. And Saru gets real confrontational.
Was it awkward to watch?
It was awkward. And you know what my favorite, one of my favorite elements of that scene was Burnham in the background, like, giving looks to Saru, like, just like shaking her head and trying to basically talk him down silently. I love that little touch.
Actually, you know what? Do you know who else gave a great look, though? Detmer.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Detmer was like, I want to be anywhere else right now.
Yeah.
But
like, Saru.
Does Saru seem to be ready to captain?
Like, okay. This is a character who's gone through a major transformation. Yes. He's not in the, I think, mental headspace to be sitting down and, like, commanding the ship yet.
This is episode 6 of season 2. I wonder where he's going to be by, say, episode 14 of season 2.
Of course,
And because I really think, I think they need a permanent captain by season 3.
Wait, aren't we just going to have a new captain every season?
I would actually think that'd be great. I would love that. But how many commanders do you have aboard this ship? I think there's, what, 4?
Yeah.
So maybe, no, 5? Because is Culber not a lieutenant commander as well?
He might be, yeah.
I think he is. Here's what I'm incredibly confused by. Who is the chief medical officer aboard Discovery? Because they established last season
that someone had, like, Andorian flu or something like that.
Yes, yeah. Because they established last season that Culber was not the chief medical officer because they asked the chief medical officer to report to sickbay to help, you know, cure the Andorian flu.
Yeah.
But Culber was a lieutenant is a lieutenant commander. If you look at Dr. Pollard's ranking, I think she's either a lieutenant or a junior lieutenant. So Culber outranks her.
Yeah.
So who is this mystery CMO aboard the ship now?
Who's the chief engineer?
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of weird.
So the chief engineer must be a commander. Culber's a commander. There must be a CMO who's a commander. So there's, like, 7 or 8 commanders aboard this ship. All of them could potentially be captain next season.
I can appreciate that Discovery
Tig Notaro is also a commander too.
That's true, yeah. Also absent in this episode. Yes. But you know, it's funny. I appreciate that Discovery has put a lot of the spotlight on characters who are a little lower down the ranks, just for the storytelling it's offered us and everything.
Lower down the decks, Ken.
Lower decks, yeah. But it does make it seem like these chief engineers and chief medical officers are really asleep at the wheel when all this like frantic, major, life-changing stuff's going on and they are absent.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of the whole like Argyle conundrum you know, early TNG, where it's like, why was the chief engineer never in any of the observation lounge meetings?
Right.
Whatever. Let's address this, though. The Culber stuff.
Yeah.
I thought it was weird in the previous episode, Saints of Imperfection, that they really did not address the big Saru stuff that went on in the previous episode.
Mm-hmm.
But they do address here.
Yeah.
Culber is back. He is dealing with the fact that his DNA has been reconstituted in this universe, right. Which you brought this up in your voicemail last week.
Yeah, where he apparently got a haircut and a shave.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works even after they established his DNA has been reconstituted.
Yeah. Shouldn't
then all his hair be gone? Like, shouldn't he have like a bald scalp?
Right, like being reborn, kind of like almost like an infant all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think we're just going to have to let this one go.
Okay. But I think it's good that they are addressing it right out of the gate that mm-hmm. Culber is not all right.
Yeah.
Do you think Stamets seems a little naive right now?
Yeah, very much so. He seems oblivious.
Yeah.
Which is going to be interesting because, like, to Stamets, nothing has changed, right? Like, yes, his partner died, but is now back, so everything's great, right? But for Culber, he's been on this entirely, like, bizarre journey that is going to change him forever.
He's been covering himself in fire ants for, like, 8 months.
Who hasn't done that, though?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you went to Australia, right? Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. I slept with them every night. They were just all over me. But, I mean, yeah, like, for Culber, so much has changed. I think that's going to be really interesting to see how it changes this character. I hope they aren't going to just use it to manufacture, like, drama in the terms of, like, well, we've got to split these two characters up.
And are we going to see our first Star Trek divorce?
Yeah. Like, it's just, not relating to Star Trek, but I hate TV shows or whatever where they just do that. They just engineer reasons for characters to, like, split up.
Okay.
I remember, it drove me nuts in the third Sam Raimi Spider-Man movie, how they were just finding ways to just get Mary Jane and Peter, like, mad at each other. And it was really annoying. And so I don't want to see that in these two characters who I love so much.
Buffy season 6.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Ask any Buffy fan. It'll make you so angry what they engineered to split two characters up.
Right.
Just like, anyways, I don't want that to happen with Culber and Stamets.
I think it's much more interesting to watch the two of them kind of go on this journey together to a certain degree.
But I wonder if they think that it's going to be, for the writer's perspective, going to be interesting to have conflict within this group.
Definitely.
And maybe, I just wonder what Stamets' arc is this season.
Mm-hmm.
Does Stamets seem more lost than any other character so far?
Does he get the Saru Award for season 1?
He might, you know. Yeah. Like, he just seems like to be such a standout, breakout sort of character in the first half of Discovery season 1.
Yeah.
And then ever since he went into that coma, I just don't know if they've had a great grasp on that character, aside from...
In Brother, I thought he was well-handled.
And look, he's had some great moments, though. But yeah. I want to see, like, a very, you know, end-to-end great Stamets episode. And we've yet to get that in quite some time.
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
He was my favorite character in the first half of season 1 of Star Trek Discovery. Saru has officially taken that mantle away from him at this mm-hmm. point, which is interesting to me because you and I had a lot of issues with Saru's journey in season 1 of Star Trek Discovery.
It is weird to be, you know, picking holes in Discovery for, you know, not giving Stamets, like, a great stuff at this moment where you look at all the past series and, like, characters who are ignored for weeks on end.
It was literally characters that just say, aye, aye, Captain.
Yeah, like, our expectations for what each character should be going through in a season is so different now.
But they build up those expectations because I think the writers, this is the biggest compliment you and I have been consistently paying to the series ever since season 1, is, like, I think they have a very strong grasp on who these characters are. And I think that's really what drives people towards certain Star Trek series. Whether you're, I think if you're a big Voyager fan, it's because you love the characters. If you're a big TNG fan, you love the characters.
I think it's, for me, what makes Discovery exciting to watch every week. Even though, like, I'll come off an episode I really don't like, I'm still excited to see the next one because I just know that the characters, like, offer so much.
Yeah. I don't think Tilly was necessarily well served by the May arc. So right. I am very curious where her character goes for the remaining half of the season at this point.
I do question, though, how much Spock throws a wrench into a lot of these characters' journeys in the coming episodes.
Okay, so Kim, enough talk, more Spock. Like, if we don't get Spock in next episode where Burnham declares she's going back to Vulcan,
I think
Spock's is it just in the next episode. Embarrassing that he has not arrived by the halfway point of season two?
This seems like he shows up in the halfway point.
Okay,
I think he's gonna finally make his appearance known.
I can't wait until we do a season two rewatch. We get to binge watch all the episodes, and I bet we won't even think about the fact that Spock is just talked about like half the season but never seen. Which I think like that's legit. Bad writing. Like, it's just, it's writing 101. You just really can't do that. But then, you know what? If we just binge watch like 6-7 hours of TV, maybe it will just float by and we won't even think about it. So it's kind of a weird conundrum that we have right now because we are watching it week to week in a series that I think the writers are writing with the idea that people, and I think it's true, are historically going to be watching this in binge watch mode, not week to week mode like we are right now.
Definitely. Yeah. A lot of people will, you know, buy their subscription to CBS All Access when the season's over and watch the whole thing in one go.
Right.
So, yeah, no, I think that will be a lot of people.
It's all the people that want to get their 1 month free and then cancel their CBS All Access subscriptions. So, come on, guys.
Yeah.
But until Picard's back on there.
But there was some just like really cool technical moments in this episode, too. One of my favorite moments in the episode was Saru walking into the turbo lift after being dismissed from the bridge, like seething with anger and like calming himself down. And then the door opens and it's a different floor and he walks back out.
Yeah.
It's all done in one shot and it looks amazing.
We've seen that in the JJ movies. Yes. I don't think we've ever seen that on a Star Trek series before, have we?
No.
Yeah.
No, but when we saw it in JJ, it was like, I think it was like two characters talking or something.
And didn't, it was like a very quick moment.
It was, yeah. Whereas like this, it was really focusing on like the emotion coming out of Saru. And then to have the door open, I was just like, wow, that was incredible.
Well, I missed it the first time, but on the second watch, I was really focusing in on, say, Doug Jones's acting.
Mm-hmm.
And just the look on his face. And you can kind of see how his character is thinking things through over the course of a few seconds and his reaction. We get to go jump into the transporter room and we get to see that transporter chief from last season who he had like the best hair in the world last season, but it's all flat now. He doesn't have like that badass haircut, which I was kind of bummed out by.
Yeah.
But what did you think of the Ba'ul's redressed transporter room that we saw with like lighting that seemed to come from like a goth club circa 1997?
Right. Yeah, there was a club in Vancouver that looked a lot like that I used to go to all the time.
What was that again? You've told
Love
me.
Love Affair.
Name. Love Affair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where is it now? What has it turned into?
Condominiums.
Is that really? What street was it on?
Seymour Street in Vancouver.
Yeah, nobody hangs out on Seymour Street anymore.
No. It's bygone days.
Condos, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
But no, yeah, I like the set for, I thought the art direction for this episode was fantastic. And I like that the Ba'ul's like fortress looked great. It looked really cool. Their ships looked neat. I like the scene where the Discovery is surrounded by them all. They looked very different from what we normally see on Star Trek ships.
So when I was watching this the first time and I see the ships appear and the fact that Bryce said audio only, I had to believe that there was going to be some sort of reveal about what made these aliens so special that we could not see them on screen. And then when I saw the ships on screen, I was like, is this supposed to be kind of like an homage to the Tholians, especially the way they're spreading around Discovery? Did you get any Tholian vibes at all at that point?
I didn't in the moment. When you say that, that makes a lot of sense.
And I wonder if they're trying to trigger that reaction within fans, even though if you kind of think back on it, it doesn't necessarily make a ton of sense because was not the Tholian web the first encounter with the Tholians?
It was.
Even though we did get to see them in Star Trek Enterprise, although that was in the Mirror universe.
Correct, yeah.
So, anyways, this is what happens when you watch way too much Star Trek. you have to, like, rationalize things in your brain as you watch it in real time.
Right. Now, What do you think of the whole Prime Directive issue?
Okay, why do they keep calling it General Order 1?
I have no idea. That sounds very sinister to me.
Yeah, why don't they just... Like, I'm wondering, is there a canon issue? Is there a reason why they just don't call it the Prime Directive? And why would somebody like Agent Tyler care? He's part of Section 31.
Yeah.
Section 31 isn't supposed to care about this sort of stuff.
They're already messing about with the Klingons.
Yeah. And let me ask you this, Cam. Okay, so based on Saru's actions... where he's very insubordinate.
Yeah.
Why on earth was Michael Burnham court-martialed for mutiny when it seems as if her actions are pretty much in line with every single main character from Star Trek in every single series?
That's true. We
did the Worf episode where we're just talking about every egregious act that Worf committed through DS9 and TNG, and we're like, how is this guy not being kicked out of Starfleet? He's literally murdering like heads of state in other empires. It's just like, okay, it just seems generally unfair to me that everybody can get away with this sort of stuff, including Saru in this episode, but Burnham is thrown into some like mining colony in episode 3, right?
I was actually not sure what to take away from this in terms of the Prime Directive, because I was like, wow, this seemed very extreme to me for completely changing the entire... I don't know. Is it a gray area because of how they're being manipulated by, you know, this species that has technology? Is that the little bit of the gray area that Discovery has to play with?
It's tough to say, because the other interesting thing, though, is they have never established within canon what the exact wording of the Prime Directive is.
Right.
So I think they have room to play. But guess what? If I am Pike and I see a warp-capable species about to commit genocide on a sentient species, I'm kind of in the Pike camp. I'm like, I'm going to fire my photon torpedoes on you, folks. Like, just an FYI.
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with that. I just was like, I wonder what Picard would have done in this situation.
Well, let me ask you this. This is what I kept coming back to. Like, okay. Let's say it wasn't Anson Mount in this role. Let's say it was a Patrick Stewart who was just a London actor we've never encountered before. I kind of believe like all the lines that we're getting from Pike, they seem as if they could be coming from Picard instead.
Right.
He is very much
written to be the like aspirational captain, the one you want to look up to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're very different characters, and I think that has to do really with what I was alluding to with the actors, though. But I think, like, line for line, a lot of what you're getting, it's stuff that I could believe Picard saying on TNG any given episode, which, to me, I think bodes well for where the writing staff is going with the Picard spinoff come this fall. I think that if Pike is some sort of analog to what we can expect, I think maybe we're in good hands, and they have kind of good grasp on, as you say, kind of that aspirational captain that we want moving forward.
I'm really hoping they can nail down Picard again, because I think it'd be fantastic to see again. We'll see. But I'm liking what they're doing with Pike. Like, this character is really working very, very well.
Yeah.
And so well that it's going to be insane if he doesn't have his own spinoff show at this point.
I mean, they can't say anything, but I think you and I are going to have, like, Jaws... like dropped if we don't hear anything after the first week of the season 2 finale, right?
Yeah.
Like, it would just seem bizarre. They're announcing spinoffs for every, like, Keiko O'Brien at this point. Like, like it makes no sense, especially when you're announcing notable names like Rebecca Romijn, Anson Mount. They made a real big deal about casting Ethan Pike in the Spock role.
Yeah.
It looks, based on that season 2 promotional video, that they had even drawn up sets for the bridge of the Enterprise, which tells me that they're amortizing costs for a possible spinoff later on, which makes the, you know, 1701 spinoff even more likely, because it's going to be cheaper for CBS with those built-in costs. It makes sense economically is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
So, yes, Cam, I have confirmation. A buddy of ours from the Star Trek Las Vegas convention, he's going in halvesies with me, Scott Hardy, on the Anson Mount photo op,
because
he's just been confirmed for the Star Trek Las Vegas convention. So I am getting my mount on. I'm getting mounted up at this point.
Nice.
It's going to be awesome.
I had one other thing to talk about, and I'm not sure how I feel about it. We've talked in the last couple episodes about Deus Ex Machinas showing up in Discovery episodes, and we had one here again where the Red Angel showed up and stopped the slaughtering of the Kelpians.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I mean,
Is it literally in the name Deus Ex Machina? Deus, which means like gods.
Yeah.
So
we are literally having the equivalent of gods in Star Trek showing up to resolve these stories.
Yeah.
And once is okay, but it seems like it's happening a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had Section 31 doing the same thing. We've had the Spore Drive doing these things. We've got Red Angels doing these things. We even had the Sphere kind of doing a little bit of that in this episode as well, giving us all the information we need.
Do you know what I think about a lot, though, is how minimal the technobabble was on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Or the
original series.
And what happened, though, is really the conflicts were resolved by characters' actions.
Yeah.
Not outside influences, really. And look, believe me, there are exceptions.
Definitely.
Blah, blah, blah. But you know what? The fact of the matter is that I think Star Trek Discovery is the best series to come out of the gate with such a strong grasp on its characters. There's no reason for the conflicts that have been created within the episodes to not be resolved by the characters themselves. So it feels like a bit of a cheat, you know, where, look, and they kind of set it up. Like, Pike could have fired all those photon torpedoes and maybe some Kelpians would have perished somehow. I don't know. Like, there would have been consequences, but was this Deus Ex Machina here necessary for the self-contained story that they're telling?
Or Pike gets through to them. He's able to actually broker some sort of agreement or some sort of ceasefire.
He could give a classic Kirk sort of speech.
Yeah. You know?
Like, I would like to see that, you know, kind of the Kirk talking down the computer system.
Right.
He is always great at doing.
Yeah.
You know?
I was kind of, I'm not going to say it ruined the episode for me in any way, shape, or form, but it was kind of like, oh, this again.
Yeah.
Discovery, you can't go to this well this often, or it starts to become a little hackneyed.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that they can maybe lay off. I mean, I will say this much. They actually brought some new information to the table with this Deus Ex Machina.
Cam, it took 6 episodes for us to get any, like, real information on the Red Angels. We're almost halfway through the season.
Yeah.
This is just, like, stretching it out a little bit too long, in my opinion. I think you're asking too much of the audience.
Yeah. And so, I'm not sure where I stand on Red Angels at the moment, is what I'm saying. I'm still grappling with it myself.
I can tell you, like, look, if the payoff is really great,
yeah,
you and I were very skeptical about the Volk and Tyler payoff.
Yeah.
It was actually pretty exceptional.
Yeah.
So I will maintain faith in them to deliver at this point, but so far, I'm not particularly entranced by this Red Angel story that we're getting.
No, I'm in the same boat, but we'll see. We'll see what comes up next.
Okay.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Next week, we'll be back with the latest episode of Discovery. Will Spock appear? Only time will tell. Okay.
Less talk, more Spock.
You can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vahari, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P. P as in pristine is how Dr. Pollard describes one Dr. Culbert.
That's right.
O-R-T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.